3. High time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's Mighty Prom and join Donald MacLeod.
Thank you, Sean. Tonight, we're waving the banner of the 150th anniversary celebrations of Mahler's birth in grand style with a performance of his immense Third Symphony. A lot of numbers come together tonight, too. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra is 75, though you'd never think so to look at them. And this, the second of their pair of proms, is his first proms appearance with them of their chief conductor of getting on for a year now, Donald Runnicles. This is also the first of a trio of Mahler symphonies over the next couple of evenings. But when critics in Berlin first heard just three movements of Mahler's Third Symphony in 1897, they wrote him off as a lunatic and a megalomaniac. They couldn't get their heads around this completely unprecedented music, and they didn't hear the huge first movement at all. Mahler's symphonies are full of ambiguities and contradictions. Leaving aside the performers, this symphony makes huge demands of us, the listeners, subjecting us to a barrage of sounds and noises from across the complete spectrum, deluging us with emotion and evoking the whole range of life, from flowers to angels. At times it soars celestially, at others we're plunged into inchoate mutterings, battered by crude military assaults. And naive, almost vulgar tunes are woven together with the most refined harmonies. Jaunty military marches emerge, and so do what sound like pre-echoes of pop songs. And there are definitely echoes of Beethoven and Wagner, and probably others too. Donald Runnicles has an interesting perspective on Mahler 3.
I think this would be the ideal work for Fantasia 2010. Some of this one does animate in some ways in one's mind, and I do genuinely imagine in that third movement. And that's perhaps the childlike, well, not only in me, but I think in the music. It encourages to imagine the birds and the bees and these little animals, and they're all careening around in the forest. And then all of a sudden, you have the feeling that some dark cloud has suddenly appeared, and the light changes, like what happens when a storm is approaching.
There are a number of incredibly powerful movements in this symphony, not least when we've come through all this amazing kaleidoscope of colour, and then the clouds seem to part, and out of this miraculous soundscape emerges a single human voice.
It's the frailty of a single human voice. One feels this vast natural landscape and this one small voice, and yet in that one small voice is humanity, and even back then, you feel humanity getting its relationship with nature all wrong. It's a very dark movement, and then, of course, out of this emerges another single note, and this time it's children's voices. And it's our only hope, if you like.
Tonight's conductor, Donald Runnicles. Well, Mahler started out with a program for his Third Symphony, a musical poem embracing all the stages of development in progressive order, beginning with inanimate nature and rising to the love of God. But he subsequently withdrew that. He called the first vast movement Summer Marches In, and it was intended to portray the awakening of nature out of winter through spring into summer. But it seems to express something even more fundamental, the process of creation itself. The second movement was headed, at an early stage, What the Flowers Tell Me. The third's a scherzo, and it's based on one of Mahler's own songs about the birds and the beasts. Then comes a setting for a mezzo-soloist, sung tonight by Karen Cargill of Friedrich Nietzsche's Midnight Song, describing the hopes and fears of mankind. The fifth also has a part for the singer, as she's joined by the children's and women's voices suggesting the angels. Tonight, the women's voices of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus and the Junior Chorus of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. The text is from the German folk poem collection Das Knaben Wunderhorn, Youth's Magic Horn, and it begins, "The angels were singing a sweet song." The sixth and final movement is a purely orchestral adagio, and it was intended to express the love of God for mankind. That applaud for the guest leader of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, Marcia Crayford. Packed Albert Hall, as you can hear, rapidly attentive and waiting for this mighty symphony to begin. And here's the man to do it, Donald Ronicles is going to conduct Mahler's third symphony. At the very beginning, Mahler told a friend, "It's almost ceased to be music. It's hardly anything but the sounds of nature."
Thank you. Thank you.
The wildest thing I've ever done. The voice of nature. Life, the prisoner of motionless, inanimate nature, cries out in the distance and pleads for freedom until in the end it breaks out victoriously. That's how Gustav Mahler himself described that first movement of his Symphony No. 3. As you can hear, a short pause now here in the Royal Albert Hall, as Mahler himself proposed to allow the musicians a bit of a breather and to give us, the audience, a moment or two to take in what we've just heard before he reveals the rest of the vast canvas of this work. The pause also makes a logical place for the mezzo-soprano soloist to take her place on the platform. That's Karen Cargill tonight. And we'll hear her in the fourth movement as that lone voice singing words from Friedrich Nietzsche's Also sprach Zarathustra. It begins, O Mensch, gib acht, O man, take heed, what says deep midnight. Donald Ronicles conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the second part of Mahler's Symphony No. 3.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
can the spirit that has dwelt upon the eternal creation thoughts of the deity in such a symphony as this die? No, one grows confident that everything is eternally and unalterably born for the good. The most sublime cheerfulness prevails, an eternally radiant day. For gods, to be sure, and not men, for whom it is the great and the terrible unknown, something eternally ungraspable. Mahler's own words on his third symphony, that enigmatic, perplexing, ambiguous, magnificent achievement of his, which speaks to us so powerfully a century after it was first heard complete. We've just heard it performed here at the BBC Proms by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra with their chief conductor, Donald Ronicles. The mezzo-soprano soloist was Karen Cargill, and we also heard the women's voices of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, 70 of them, and 50 girls and boys' voices of the junior chorus of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, their chorus master in both cases, Christopher Bell. There were some marvellous orchestral solos, which Donald Ronicles has already acknowledged. Simon Johnson, principal trombonist of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Some doubt about whether he'd be with us here tonight because his wife was expecting a baby, but the boy, the third, arrived safely on Saturday. The horn solos were played by David Flack. Tonight's guest leader, Marcia Crayford, also contributed several solos, as you heard, and the off-stage post-horn in the third movement had heart-squeezing, wonderful music by Mahler. It was played by the BBC Symphony Orchestra's, BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's principal trumpet, Mark O'Keefe. Karen Cargill returning with Christopher Bell and Donald Ronicles. Karen Cargill, a girl from Arbroath, a small town girl, she describes herself, brought up on the Beatles, ABBA and Boney M at home, who played in the local brass band. She told me, and I'm sure she was just being nice, that she listens to Radio 3 at home some of the time, but mostly she sings along to Lady Gaga. Donald Ronicles relishing the possibility of achieving a symphony like this in his position as chief conductor of the BBC Scottish, not the kind of thing that you can program as a guest conductor. Well, if you're a Mahler fan, you'll want to be in tune again with Radio 3 tomorrow night when Valery Gergiev will be here with his World Orchestra for Peace with two Mahler symphonies, numbers 4 and 5. But hard on our heels, later tonight, the late night prom where Bach meets Stravinsky, the BBC Singers and the London Sinfonietta conducted by David Atherton. Bach's variations on Von Himmelhoff, Stravinsky's take on that and Stravinsky's Thraney. That's at 10 o'clock. But in the meantime, I'll return you to the safekeeping of Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Donald MacLeod at the Royal Albert Hall. And you can hear that prom again on the BBC iPlayer. That's at bbc.co.uk/iPlayer. Or you can watch it on BBC4 television tomorrow night starting at 7:30. Well, next this evening, Turkey in Europe. 400 years ago, much of Central Europe was under Turkish rule, and the traces of their presence remain to this day. Yet many nations still resist Turkey joining the EU. Is this because they're in denial about the past influence of the Ottoman Empire? Dennis Marks poses that question to contemporary Austrians, Bosnians and Turks to discover what they share and what they fear. That's at 9 o'clock, in about 11 minutes' time. Well, as we just heard, there's Bach in our next prom, and I thought we'd hear music by Bach arranged by Mahler now. In 1909, when Mahler was in New York as conductor of the New York Philharmonic, he arranged music from Bach's orchestral suites. Mahler directed the orchestra himself from the harpsichord and would improvise the continuo part, much as players did in the 17th century. He also added instruments to Bach's orchestra, notably three flutes, usually played in unison. Well, we'll hear part of Mahler's suite from orchestral works by J.S. Bach, played by the Radio Symphony Orchestra of Berlin, conducted by Peter Rozhitska. The three movements we'll hear now are Rondo and Badinery, Air and Gavotte. ¶¶
Thank you.
Bach, arranged by Mahler, part of the suite from orchestral works by J.S. Bach. The harpsichord was played by Peter Schwarz, the solo flautist was Martin Ulrich Sen, and the Radio Symphony Orchestra of Berlin was conducted by Peter Ruzicka. And our late prom today at 10 o'clock is a concert of Bach and Stravinsky, given by the BBC Singers and the London Sinfonietta, conducted by David Atherton. That's here on BBC Radio 3, and the time is now coming up to 9:05. And we've another chance to hear a programme in which the filmmaker and broadcaster Dennis Marks visits Vienna and Sarajevo to discover the legacy of Turkey in Europe.
The Stephansdom in Vienna, St. Stephen's Cathedral. It's the Catholic hub of a very Catholic country. So it's rather strange that for more than a century, its spire was crowned not by a gleaming cross, but a Muslim crescent. The mighty Ottoman host assembled by Suleiman the Magnificent in 1529 never reached this grand Habsburg square, but it was a close call. A century and a half later, the Ottomans staged a return match, and it was only with the aid of Polish troops that Vienna fought Istanbul to a draw. The crescent was removed from the spire and safely stored in one of the city's museums. But here in the Austrian capital, you don't have to walk very far to detect traces of what the Ottomans once described as Turkey in Europe. During the 18th century, when the Ottoman Empire was a feeble ghost of its former self, Turkey became fashionable in a rather patronising way. The Empress Maria Theresia had her portrait painted in Turkish dress. Her nephew, Joseph II, commissioned an opera from Mozart set in an Ottoman seraglio, with the Turkish Pasha playing the part of the good guy. Mozart just about sums up our attitude to Turkey in Europe. At one and the same time, it's distant and seductive, immediate and vaguely threatening. The Turks were finally defeated in 1683, more than three centuries ago, but they still haunt Vienna in more ways than one. They're present in the city's food and drink, its architecture and its design. But there's another Turkey in Europe, a Turkey of grudgingly tolerated migrant workers who come from a very different nation from the Empire of Suleiman. This programme is about the ambivalent relationship between near neighbours, something that puzzles Austrians and Turks alike. The retiring Turkish ambassador is Selim Yenil.
One thing that really struck me was a lack of knowledge between the two sides. Although we've been living together, either in this country or as neighbours throughout the millennia, we don't have a correct understanding of each other, and that's quite a pity. 1683 traumatised the population here, and you can see it all around the city. There's a lot of reminders of the Ottomans and the Turks. While as we in 1923 and onwards changed our perception towards the West to become a westernised country ourselves, and we thought that this was accepted by most of the Western countries, up until the Cold War, we thought that this was the case, and only when the Cold War ended did we find out that it was only us that changed and that Europe and Europeans did not change so much.
Cengiz Gunay is a political scientist working in Austria. His special interest is cultural and social transformation.
Today, people mainly remember, or school books teach mainly about the conflict. Actually, the Ottoman Empire opened itself in the beginning with the 17th, 18th century and was open to influence from Europe, more in cultural terms and also in political terms.
Entschuldigung.
Ja,
guten Tag.
Ein
großes Schwarze, bitte.
Ja.
Und ein Mineralwasser.
Turkey is with us here from dawn to dusk. Here, in Julius Meinl's coffee house, I'm drinking a concoction which was first brewed after a Ukrainian officer was given some bags of beans left behind by retreating Ottoman armies. Even the croissants they're eating over there have dubious Turkish connections. There's a legend that they too are a double-edged tribute to the might of the Muslim crescent.
What was the magnetic pull that drew the armies of Suleiman the Magnificent to the gates of Vienna? They'd conquered North Africa and Arabia, and their reach extended as far as Central Asia. So why did they need to plant the crescent banner on the foothills of the Alps? Perhaps it was because Suleiman's grandfather hadn't quite closed the deal 80 years before. Professor Andrew Wheatcroft has made a lifetime study of the aspirations of the Ottoman Turks.
A young man in his 20s, and what he wanted to do was to make a mark on the world. And he also wanted, it seems to me, to right the wrong that he felt had been done to the Ottomans over the centuries. A tremendous sense of a dynastic inheritance as far as the Ottomans are concerned. And it was an easy push. Much better organised army, moved into Hungary, useless Hungarian army, founded on outdated Western models. The Ottomans defeated them at the Battle of Mohacs, sat behind a whole row of wooden poles with their artillery and blasted them to pieces, basically.
But as it turned out, Vienna in the 16th century was no pushover. The Habsburgs were much better equipped than their Hungarian cousins, and the Sultan's army was repulsed. It took another century and a half before the Ottomans were in a position to have a second crack at penetrating Western Europe.
Why did they go to Vienna in the first place? For fantastical reasons. And the reason was that if they were able to take Vienna, Karim Mustafa, who was the Grand Vizier at the time, felt that it would be something that would make him unique in the history of the Ottoman Empire. He would have achieved what Suleiman failed to achieve. And it was a kind of fantasy, and I think that the fantasy was it would fulfil a whole lot of statements of destiny, so to speak, that were kind of replete in the Ottoman histories.
Tradition places the Ottoman retreat in Kahlenberg, on the Vienna hills to the northwest of the city. I followed that tradition 10 years ago when I told the story for a Radio 3 documentary about Vienna. But I was probably wrong on two counts. Most historians now believe that the Turkish armies gathered on the Leopoldsburg, half a mile to the east. And the victorious army was led by King John Sobieski of Poland. So it wasn't an Austrian victory, and it happened somewhere else. Nevertheless, the notion that Austria saved Christendom from Muslim dominance still persists.
The fantasy, and I think it is a fantasy, that the Turks were going to kind of end up on sort of the English Channel, was very unlikely. But the interesting thing is that people believed that this could happen. The event was so shocking that they could surround the city. I think that that dug very deep into the kind of Western psyche.
Still, the Austrian Habsburgs wanted to make sure that no one forgot their successes in coming to the defence of Christian Europe. When the Emperor Franz Josef ordered the largest arsenal in the Western world to be built here on the outskirts of the city, he also commissioned an imperial war museum and stuffed it with Ottoman plunder from the previous two centuries. Here's the great seal of Mustafa Pasha, captured by Prince Eugene of Savoy at the Battle of Lenva in 1697. In the next gallery is the huge tent of Damad al-Pasha, which Eugene plundered and adopted as a mobile hunting lodge. Most impressive of all is the mortar of Belgrade, which hit the Ottoman ammunition dump and wiped out 3,000 Turkish soldiers in the process. That was in 1717, and it marked the final failed attempt of the Ottoman Empire to command Central Europe. But Vienna was only an episode in a story which continued until the end of the First World War. Despite the slow decline of Ottoman Turkey, those eastern ghosts have continued to haunt the Austrians. Valeria Heuberger is a social and cultural historian who specialises in the minorities of Central and Eastern Europe. She sees relations between Turkey and her European neighbours as a complex mosaic.
Historical images or historical myth differ from Eastern and Western Austria. So for Eastern Austria, especially for Vienna, the danger for many centuries came definitely from the East, which was true. It was going back to medieval times, it was the Hungarians, then it was the Turkish armies, the Ottoman armies for many centuries. Also in popular culture, many songs, many poems, many legends deal with these belligerent centuries, with this warfare which lasted for centuries between the Habsburg Empire and between the Ottoman Empire.
Austria today has the second largest Turkish population in Europe. In Vienna, at the end of Ramadan, tents are erected on the edge of the Ringstrasse, and tourists are offered oriental sweets and pastries, accompanied by the tinkle of a Turkish lute. On the surface, the city authorities are generous hosts to their Turkish minorities, but superficial impressions can sometimes be misleading. Vienna's 10th district is Austria's little Istanbul, or at least it should be. But most of the Ottoman residue in the city is restricted to a few fragments scattered around the Habsburg monuments of the inner town. Tonight, we're in Atip, the Turkish cultural and faith centre, located in a nondescript 60s block off the main thoroughfare. Low ceilings, blank walls, and the only colour coming from the vivid traditional shawls and skirts of the women, segregated at the far end of the room from their business-suited middle-aged menfolk. Here in the Turkish Bezirk, the only Ottoman echoes are in the background chatter and the baklava and the salads on the table. Tonight is a bayram, a festival to mark the end of Ramadan, given a little extra spice by blending with a farewell party for the departing Turkish ambassador. For Vienna's Turkish guest workers, it's a celebration tinged with anxiety, as the ambassador knows only too well.
The guest workers have come here, but I think that to many Austrians they have overstayed their welcome. They were supposed to go back, but they did not. They decided to stay here for economic reasons, for well-being. And some have integrated well, but not all. And those who have not integrated well look different than the Austrians. And of course, this caused some resentment. And let me be candid here. I think that religion and culture does play a certain role here. I mean, previous minorities were of the same, at least, if not Catholic, but at least they were all Christian. And now we're talking about a Muslim minority, which is different. 9/11 has not helped. The things that we see in the Middle East or Afghanistan have not helped. This all gives Islam or the Muslims a bad name.
If conflicts come into being, I would say it's not only because a woman is wearing a headscarf or a man would wear a traditional Arab garment. The point is that very often different lifestyles cause problems. Sometimes if you stroll through these marketplaces, you feel like you're in Istanbul or Sarajevo or somewhere else in a more oriental part or more Balkan part of Europe. But I would say that's more or less the same process which is going on Europe-wide. So Austria is no exception.
It's only 9 subway stops from the Stephansdom to Brunnengasse, but I might as well have bought a ticket to Ankara. The Brunnenmarkt sits on the outskirts of the Gürtel, Vienna's outer ring road. The market is a little more relaxed and less manic this afternoon than the 10th district was yesterday. Ramadan is ended. The mad dash to eat and drink once the sun has set is now over. There's more time to take in Zumrut, the jewellers, the bridal shops, the carpet dealers, the aubergines and hot peppers on the food stalls, the salty white cheeses, olives, and stalls that sell nothing but coffee. Over there is Burka Textil and Istanbul Textil. The Harp restaurant is still offering iftar itap, the special 6:30 buffet to break the fast. And the sound of the Turkish language is spiced with the occasional burst of Kurdish. In Brunnengasse, you could be forgiven for thinking that Austria is the model of multiculturalism. But we shouldn't forget that the anti-immigrant Freedom Party has twice held the balance of power in parliament. The sociologist Cengiz Günay has a more nuanced view of Austrian tolerance.
I think Austria is a country which is not used to integrate different cultures in a way, because we have a long history of integration. Look at all the Czechs and Slovaks and Hungarians and so on and so forth. We integrated during the era of the Habsburg Empire. But of course, that was assimilation, actually. So integration is very often mixed up with the assimilation, and people expect migrants to become Austrians, like any other Austrian, to change probably their names into Hans and Grete or something. And it is less accepted that they are behaving in a different way.
These sentiments are shared by a small but vocal group of Austrian politicians in local and national government. Omar Al-Rawi was born in Baghdad, but as a city councillor, he represents all Vienna's Muslim minorities.
Most of them mixed up integration with assimilation. And this comes back also to its historian development. We had a lot of Hungarians, Czech, Bohemians, the so-called Ostbloc countries. And all these people went the way of assimilating themselves. So you just rarely find only their names called Pavkovic and Svoboda and Veseli and Klestil. But they lost their language, they lost their former culture, they lost even the ability of their cooking and kitchen. And that's why the Viennese and the Austrians, only when they see someone who lost everything except his name, he is a well-integrated person. That is one of the things which sometimes with the Islam, because it's another faith, it's another religion, there are some habits and customs which will never change. Of course, one of the huge problems is this wearing the headscarf, which causes for a lot of the ladies extremely discrimination when they want to get a job. And we have to admit that there is a new phenomenon in Europe and also in Austria, it's called Islamophobia. And this phenomenon would be a challenge for both of the society to deal with in the next years.
Istanbul-born Alev Korun sits in the National Parliament. She's an MP for the Greens, but her brief also includes minority issues. She, too, is conscious of the legacy of Austria's past relations with her Turkish neighbours.
In the public consciousness in Austria, there is still very much living the fact that the so-called Turks, or we call them actually Ottomans in Turkey, that Ottomans have been trying to conquer Austria or Vienna. In public schools, pupils hear that the Turks were trying to conquer Austria. And this has, of course, quite heavy consequences on pupils with a Turkish background living in Austria, you know, to hear that you, in quote marks, tried to conquer our country, which is not good, I think, because many of these pupils are Austrian citizens. They were born in Austria, they grow up in Austria, and they will be the managers and the teachers and the politicians of our country from tomorrow.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
In the 10th district, the sound of evening prayers and the ubiquitous headscarves and hijabs are constant reminders of the otherness of Vienna's Muslim minorities. But otherness in Vienna is not a new phenomenon.
The last census from 1910 indicated that Franz Joseph, the old emperor, he ruled over approximately 52 million people. And we had various nations, we had Slavic people, we had, of course, Hungarians, Italians, Ukrainians, Czechs, Slovaks, Romanians, and many other. And among these many groups, there was also one group of Muslims living in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So that Viennese, that Austrians got acquainted with Islam, goes back already to the time of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Ah, yes, Bosnia. The only European country where Muslims make up more than 80% of the population. A nation synonymous in the media not with integration, but with disintegration. I've visited the country three times since the War of the 90s, and I've grown to love Sarajevo, that most Ottoman city west of Turkey. If Austria is deeply conflicted about its Turkish legacy, perhaps Bosnia can give us a different image of Turkey in Europe. The former Oxford professor of modern history, Norman Stone, is now based in Ankara and Istanbul. For him, Bosnia isn't a symbol of conflict, but a testament to the successful collaboration of two cultures.
They got on very well in Bosnia. In the days of Suleiman, 17th century, it's a very go-ahead place, and it was on a major trade route running to Dubrovnik. Sarajevo was an important place, and it works in a way that Western European cities at the time would not have worked, you know, with proper running water and attempts to control epidemics. Also, the other thing that's so striking about Bosnia is that the native Bosnians and the Ottomans got along perfectly well. I mean, if you think of the numbers of people who were very prominent in the Ottoman court, an awful lot of them were Bosnian, including some of the very great, memorable grand viziers, all came from that part of the world.
So how did this epitome of tolerance come to symbolise racial disharmony? Let's hear what some native Bosnians have to say. We'll begin with the leader of Bosnia's Muslims, the Grand Mufti Imam Ceric.
The nature of Bosnia has been for more than 1,000 years of the multicultural, multi-ethnical, multinational society. This is not something new, because Bosnia-Herzegovina is a treasure of this multicultural and multinational environment, which we cannot destroy. I am shocked that we don't have partners in Europe to understand that. I am shocked that Europe is not helping us to keep this multicultural and multinational state.
How about a politician? Ejup Ganic was president of Bosnia-Herzegovina in the late 1990s.
We are an original country which has a diversity of everything. And those countries which are multidimensional in that respect are not common in Europe to some extent. So that's why there are some troubles, jealousy, or whatever you call for, that exist here. But we are small and beautiful, original, and we continue to survive all the infections that they are trying to impose on us from the side.
Mirsad Pulavatra found inspiration in Bosnia's multicultural past when he launched the Sarajevo Film Festival, even as the snipers fired on the city from the surrounding hills.
Let's start with the region, considering the region step by step as some kind of the crossing road or as a central point of two big empires. Because Sarajevo spent 500 years under the Ottoman Empire and 50, but very successful and very nice, 50 years of Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And we found that those two empires are really meeting each other in Sarajevo. In one street, in just 50 meters, you can see very strong traces of Ottoman Empire, and just next 5 meters you can see such beautiful Austrian-Hungarian buildings or some other traces.
When I first came to Sarajevo 12 years ago, I did what every passing hack did. I grabbed an overpriced taxi from the airport, stayed at that dreary legend, the Holiday Inn on Sniper's Alley, and entered the city from the west. Walking down Marshal Tito Street, it was a shock when the paving stones suddenly became cobbles and a Habsburg city transformed into a Turkish market. Coming this time from the Ottoman east is a quite different experience. Four minarets guard the four corners of the bazaar. Greeting visitors at the entrance to the old town is Istanbul Turksi Doner Kebab. Every second shop is Turka or Divan. Coppersmiths hammer, and the music is all traditional Sevda, the melancholy love songs which were born in the years when Sarajevo was governed from Istanbul by the sublime Porte. The whole district is called Bajasha, the bazaar district, and that's what it does, buying and selling. It always did, From the moment that the Sultan Bayezid II established Ottoman rule here at the turn of the 16th century, Sarajevo is, was, and hopefully always will be, the most Ottoman cosmopolis west of the Bosphorus. It was not only a power centre for the empire, even more important, it was the primary trading post between East and West. You'd find goods from Persia, the Levant, and even as far distant as Central Asia. Sitting here in the cobbled wooden courtyard of the Moricha Han, which was a pit stop for spice and silk merchants for 300 years, you can sip better Turkish coffee than you'll get in Izmir and buy a kelim at knockdown